Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman who is very much in the front lines of that war at the moment in the United States Congress is our first guest. She is Representative Vicki Hartzler. She represents with great distinction the people of the 4th District of Missouri. She was elected to the Congress in 2010. She is a subcommittee chairwoman in the House Armed Services Committee with its Oversight and Investigations Subcommittee's responsibilities. She also serves on that committee's Subcommittee on Intelligence, Emerging Threats and Capabilities. And in that regard, I'm particularly anxious to talk with you. Congresswoman, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here.
Speaking of emerging threats, madam, we seem to be watching a kind of slow motion train wreck, or maybe even accelerating train wreck, with respect to this Obama bomb deal, as I call it. I know you've been very concerned about this, and you've been talking to your constituents about why. Share with us a little bit of your thoughts, if you would, both about the nuclear parts of this deal and the possibility that with their $150 billion windfall, the Iranians may wind up with an awful lot bigger and more deadly conventional arsenal as well.
Absolutely. There are many, many reasons to oppose this bad deal. First and foremost, it does not stop Iran's nuclear capability. And at the end of 10 to 15 years, they will have all of the infrastructures that they need. They'll be able to continue to enrich with even higher ability centrifuges. They'll have done research that we are mandated to help them with. And they'll have money to do it. And so it's very, very concerning. We are actually paving the way for them to be able to have a nuclear bomb. But as you mentioned, there's other concerns as well. Not only does it remove the economic sanctions and the personnel sanctions that will infuse the country with up to $150 billion immediately, plus allow them to grow their economy with other nations, they will be able to use this to help shore up their proxies in the area, whether it be Hamas or Hezbollah or the Houthis, and continue their reign of terrorism in the Middle East. It also removes, after 5 years, their ability to not buy arms, and it will allow them to buy anything they want, from tanks to bullets to shoulder-fired rockets, you name it. And after 8 years, they will have the ability to once again purchase ballistic missiles. And as Secretary of Defense Ash Carter said, we don't call them ICBMs for nothing. The I in ICBM stands for intercontinental. And certainly when they have said multiple times they want death to America and death to Israel, why would we be enabling them to purchase these items? It is ludicrous.
And one of the things that is particularly worrying to me, as you may know, Congressman Vicki Hartzler of Missouri, is that it may not be 5 to 8 years before those embargoes go over the side. It appears from the language of this agreement that if the International Atomic Energy Agency issues a finding that there's no active nuclear weapons program in Iran, they may get out of jail free right quick. So your concerns are especially warranted in light of that possibility. But let me ask you, Congresswoman, given everything that you've said, what do you make of the fact that the Obama administration is apparently now determined not to allow a vote to take place in the United States Senate on a resolution of disapproval? Apparently, they've concluded that if the president allows that to happen and then has to veto the thing, that would be a problem for them, I think, properly, politically and diplomatically. But do you think this is advisable or even tolerable?
But it's unconscionable. He agreed to this earlier and said, yes, I'll allow a vote. We passed in Congress the bill that gives us, the representatives of the people, the right to weigh in on this. And now at the last minute to say, no, we're going to block that is just the final straw that that needs to just derail this entire thing. And it shows how poor this deal is. And the president doesn't even trust the ability of the people to vote on it, it just has got to be stopped.
I'm wondering how your constituents are responding as you go around your district talking about what's going on here and the implications of it.
Well, they're just very, very upset and almost totally unified. There's handfuls of people that believe that it's good, but overall, I would guess it's probably 80% of my district, of at least the people I've talked to in August, are opposed to it. They just shake their heads. They cannot imagine why the leadership of our country would negotiate such a poor deal that only not only jeopardizes our country, but our greatest allies in the Middle East.
Well, I commend you, Congresswoman Hartzler, for making this an educational moment for your constituents. I gather you've got an hour-long presentation that you're giving them, and I hope that your colleagues have been doing the same. If they do, I think they'll get the same kinds of response. Surprised to see that Senator McCaskill was one of those who, to use her colleague Senator Bob Menendez's phrase, has decided to put her name on the bomb that Iran is going to be getting. I think that's a terrible mistake, and I hope she'll reconsider. Congressman Hartzler, let me return to two other topics that I know you're very engaged in quickly. One is the sequestration. You understand, particularly with your subcommittee on readiness responsibilities, how dire the impact of this has been on our nation's military. Is it going to be over the side as a result of the National Defense Authorization Act, or will the president veto that too?
Well, I certainly hope not. I am both a member of the Armed Services Committee as well as the Budget Committee, and I fought very hard to try to get more funding for our defense this year and to replace some of these cuts. We were able to secure $38 billion and gets us just back up to the bare, ragged, lower edge of readiness. A quote from Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, that we need this year, but we have got to reverse this sequestration. It is absolutely ludicrous that over this sequestration 10-year period, we would be cutting $1 trillion from our defense at the same time that we have threats arising against us from all over the world almost on a daily basis. And it's awful.
It is, and I commend you for what you're trying to do in different capacities and pray that you will succeed, and at least for the United States military, it's clearly having a devastating effect. Congressman, one of the other things you've been a leader on during your time in the Congress is trying to preserve our ability to use the facility at Guantanamo Bay to not only detain safely some of the most dangerous jihadists in the world, but also to conduct necessary interrogations of people in that facility. The president is apparently beavering ahead with his determination to close it, including by bringing some number of these detainees to the United States. Give us a flavor of what the stakes are in this decision of his and what might be done to prevent it at this point.
Well, first of all, his actions are a violation of the law if he tries to actually bring them here, because Congress has clearly spoken in the NDAA and in the Armed Services Committee. We have said and put language in there that they cannot bring any detainee from Guantanamo Bay to the United States. And it's not only a threat to Americans who may live in that area to have terrorists cows here on our land. It also brings into question a lot of constitutional issues and what rights do these prisoners would they potentially have when they get on our shores. You know, I had an opportunity to lead a congressional delegation down to Guantanamo Bay a couple of months ago as part of my duties as chairwoman of the Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee, because we are completing this investigation of the swap for Sergeant Bergdahl with the five Taliban leaders. And I wanted to personally see what goes on down there, to tour the facilities and to visit with the men and women in uniform who are carrying out the difficult task of housing and securing them. And I was very, very impressed with the operation. Our men and women in uniform are doing a very, very excellent job. And the facilities themselves are very appropriate for these terrorists. They are very humanely treated, but they are kept secure on an island away from the American citizens, and it's the proper place to house these individuals. We don't need to bring them here on our shore, and I'm going to continue to do everything I can to make sure that doesn't happen.
Bless you. Well, we look forward to working with you on that and so many of these other issues. Congresswoman Vicki Hartzler, we appreciate your leadership on all of these fronts. Keep it up and come back to Washington tanned, rested, and ready, as they say, because you'll have your work cut out for you on the Iran deal, among other things. In the meantime, I hope the rest of your district work period, I guess is what it's called, is productive and that you continue your pedagogy with your constituents. Thanks so much for joining us. Next up, we'll speak with Justin Johnson, the Heritage Foundation. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war, from Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. Justin Johnson is our guest. He is a senior policy analyst for defense budget policy at the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy at the Heritage Foundation. He formerly served as the Deputy Chief of Staff and the Military Legislative Assistant for a terrific member of Congress, Representative Doug Lamborn of Colorado. His specialty is defense expenditures and what we need to do to get them in the right places. And we're always delighted to have him with us. Justin, good to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
You have recently written about sizing the United States Navy. What should America spend on defense and why? But looking specifically, I think, at the Navy's requirements and how adequately or inadequately we are spending on it. Give us a flavor, quickly, sort of an overview of where we stand with respect to the Navy and its kind of microcosmic status in the larger area of national defense spending.
Right. Now, today we've got a Navy fleet of about 270 ships. That's about 14 or 15% smaller than the fleet we had on 9/11. And it's one of the smallest, if not the smallest, Navy we've had since the 1930s. So it's a very small fleet. Some folks in who are considering runs or are running for president are talking about the need for a larger Navy. And if you look at the budget, the Navy today only costs about 3% of the defense budget, or less than one half of 1% of total federal spending. So increasing the Navy would cost money, but it's not unaffordable by any means.
Justin, what you're talking about basically is a concept that I think many Americans take for granted. It's kind of like oxygen. We just assume there will be a Navy and that we will have the Navy do the kinds of jobs that it has historically done, certainly in the 20th century and to the present, in terms of safeguarding the sea lines of communication and ensuring free passage for trade and other purposes. But it ain't necessarily a given that those kinds of capabilities will be present or those kinds of requirements will be satisfied. Our guest is Justin Johnson of the Heritage Foundation, a senior policy analyst there with responsibility for defense budgeting policy. He formerly served on the staff of Congressman Doug Lamborn of Colorado. And, you know, again, give us a flavor, Justin, as to what the world looks like, what American interests look like if our Navy is not capable of safeguarding our interests on the waters of the world.
Frank, you got it exactly right. The point of the Navy is to protect our interests, American interests around the world. Those are things like ensuring that oil can flow freely through the Strait of Hormuz off the coast of Iran, or that commerce in general can flow freely through the South China Sea, where the Chinese are, you know, as you well know, building their brand new islands, or piracy. A few years ago, we were talking about piracy nonstop off the Horn of Africa. Our economy here in the U.S. relies on this vast international economy that we are part of. If you go to Walmart, you're going to buy things that probably came in a ship from China or India or elsewhere. If the freedom of the seas is lost, our prices spike, whether it's gasoline or whether it's matchbox cars at Walmart. So having a strong Navy to preserve those freedom of navigation around the world is vital. It's also one of the best ways to deter our potential enemies and reassure or support our friends. It's a much preferable option oftentimes to putting boots on the ground somewhere. If you put an aircraft carrier battle group off the coast, that sends a clear message without doing any damage or with very little risk.
The question, I guess, that strikes me is, and you spoke about what the Chinese are up to, they clearly are putting themselves in a position to enforce what amount to air defense intercept zones and sort of claims to the sovereignty of many of these very strategic waters of the South and East China Seas. Should they feel that the United States is unable to prevent them from projecting power from these man-made islands and constricting or at least restricting the freedom of navigation, are you saying that we would not only suffer strategically in terms of our relationships with these important allies in the region, but also economically, that this might actually affect the pocketbooks of Americans, as well as perhaps, God forbid, their future.
Absolutely, Frank. Now, I think it's easy for us to think about these issues, particularly when it comes to the Navy or, you know, security issues that are halfway around the world. We think about them in the abstract. But these issues have the very real potential to impact America and our economy writ large, but also that would impact every single American, whether it's through gasoline prices or something else. But I think the important piece here, and the reason a strong Navy is something that's worth investing in, is not simply because of the economic reason, but because a strong Navy is one of the best ways to preserve the peace, right? So as President Reagan so famously said, it's peace through strength. Our potential adversaries, whether it's China or Russia or anyone else for that matter, they recognize and respect strength. If they see a strong United States, a strong U.S. Navy, a strong U.S. military, they're far less likely to do anything that will harm our interests, economic or otherwise, or you know, our friends and allies.
Justin Johnson, let me ask you the sort of $64,000 question, I guess. As you've addressed it in a recent piece at Real Clear Defense, the affordability of the sort of Navy that would protect those equities, and of course, ultimately, the American people themselves, is the question that you've sort of wrestled with. And there's a lot of talk now on the campaign trail, as you note, about a bigger Navy with more capability, getting away from the, you know, pre-1917 size of the fleet. This will require a defense industrial base that's capable of producing considerable numbers of ships. It will require us to, you know, maintain the affordability of those ships and to man them in an affordable fashion as well. What's the bottom line? Are we capable of doing it? And for that matter, really, do we have any choice but to do it?
Yeah, I think your last question is exactly right. I think it's absolutely affordable. If you want to get to the size, you know, 350 ship Navy, which is one of the numbers that's been thrown around, and that's actually a bipartisan position for a variety of reasons. But if you want to get to that sort of Navy fleet size, you're talking less than 1% of the overall federal budget. It's very affordable. It's just a question of priorities. Is there the political will? Is there the leadership required to get there? And I think as you alluded to, there's almost the flip question is perhaps even more poignant. Can we afford not to? You know, if we're talking about preserving the peace, preserving our friendships with important countries and allies around the world, we're talking about preserving our economy, the question is, can we afford not to have a stronger Navy, I think.
The world gets a lot uglier if the United States is not strong. I think that was at the core of President Reagan's strategy or philosophy, as you say, of peace through strength. And this is a moment when it's getting pretty ugly, even without us further reducing the size and capability of our fleet and more generally our military. We spoke earlier in the program with Congressman Vicki Hensler, Justin, about the importance of relief from sequestration. I know that you're seized with that as well. We'll look forward to talking with you about that on another occasion. In the meantime, thanks so much for the work you're doing today at the Heritage Foundation and that you have done on Capitol Hill in the past. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Ambassador John Herbst, former U.S. Ambassador to the Ukraine, talks about what's happening there and what Vladimir Putin is up to there and beyond. Not more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at Facebook.com/SecureFreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, Politico reported that the Obama administration has decided it would be a disaster, politically and diplomatically, if President Obama's nuclear agreement with Iran gets through the Congress thanks to just a small partisan minority in one house.
they understand that would constitute a disastrous public repudiation of the president. So his partisans are now working to stave that off by preventing any Senate vote on the Obama bomb deal. It's bad enough that the Congress earlier this year abandoned the constitutional requirement for such a momentous agreement to be approved by two-thirds of the Senate. The administration has admitted it knew the president's appalling deal would never get that. But will Democrats now go along with a scheme to keep the Senate from even voting on it? Not if the American people hold them accountable. This is Frank Gaffney. Learn more at irontruth.org.
They are fathers and mothers, someone's best friend, and America's true heroes. Whether out on the front lines or here on the home front, our troops are sacrificing every day, making sure that we continue to have the freedoms that make this country great.
Hi, I'm Congressman Chris Stewart. As a former Air Force pilot, I understand that our troops and their families continue to give so much for our country. Let them know you appreciate their service. A simple thank you can go a long way.
Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here.
Do this better than any station in town.
Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. This week, Democratic New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez gave a powerful speech rejecting the nuclear deal with Iran, in which he said, "If Iran is to acquire a nuclear bomb, it will not have my name on it." Menendez also noted that he voted against the Iraq War, a subtle dig at President Obama's claim that opponents of the Iran deal are the same people who pushed the United States into the Iraq War. Menendez joined Senator Chuck Schumer, who announced his opposition last week. At least 10 Democratic House members are also opposing the deal. When former Democratic Senator and presidential candidate Jim Webb announced his opposition, he criticized attacks by Obama administration supporters on Schumer, which included questioning Schumer's loyalty to the United States. Members of Congress must ignore the increasingly desperate efforts by the Obama administration to defend the nuclear deal with Iran. Congress must vote to kill this deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Ambassador John Herbst is our guest. He is the director of the Atlantic Council's Dinu Patriciu Eurasia Center. He is a career foreign service officer who served in a number of different capacities, including as the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and to Uzbekistan, also the U.S. consul general in Jerusalem, among many other spots. It is a great pleasure to welcome him back. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I have been very interested in your thinking and, more generally, what is to be made of what's going on with respect to Ukraine at the moment. You served there, of course, representing our country. It has been a battleground, certainly parts of it, for some time now. Give us a sense of where things stand at the moment and, where you think they're headed.
Well, there are at least two critical sets of issues that Ukraine is dealing with. One is the aggression conducted by the Kremlin, and the other is the great economic problems that were left by the preceding government. And if you look at both together, on balance, Ukraine's position, while still very dangerous, or while still in great crisis, is better off today than it was 6 months ago. The most important thing in the past week was the negotiation successfully of a debt reduction between Ukraine and private creditors. And Ukraine is getting a 20% discount, you might say, on the debt it inherited from the Yanukovych regime. And that's a very important step towards the economic stabilization of the country. So that's new and that's important. Now, on the security side, we've seen an increase in fighting in the east over the past several weeks, but an increase along a very old pattern, which is the Kremlin and its agents in East Ukraine. They've not launched a new offensive, but they've increased their, what you might call, armed reconnaissance, where they're using firing to try and move further into Ukrainian territory. And while, of course, there's a net loss for Ukraine in this, since the second ceasefire in the middle of February, the Kremlin and its proxies have grabbed over 200 square kilometers of Ukrainian territory and killed over 200 Ukrainian soldiers. While that's obviously a very bad thing, this continuing fighting means that the sanctions on Russia will continue. And those sanctions are creating serious damage to the Russian economy. It's worth at least 1.25% of GDP per year.
Wow. Mr. Messer, you have been quoted as saying that the struggle in Ukraine is more serious than the Islamic State. It's very simple. Talk about that a little bit, because obviously there's been a lot more attention to the latter than the former for recent months.
Well, the Islamic State is a serious danger, but after all, it is only a small terrorist group. It has no ability to organize an economy or a society. All it can do is murder innocent people. And if even it's the danger of taking over states in the Middle East, while real, it is limited. And if it would take over some of those, for example, parts of Iraq or parts of Syria, it wouldn't be able to run them properly, and they would not pose an existential threat to, certainly not the United States, or to any large and stable country. Russia is one of the world's two great nuclear powers. Even with the price of oil what it is, its economy is still the largest economy. It's no longer the sixth largest economy, but at the current exchange rates and such, it's probably the 12th or the 14th largest economy. And it has the largest, strongest military in Europe. So in other words, its capacity for harm is infinitely larger than ISIS, and its intent is quite dangerous. Mr. Putin is a revisionist. He wants to change the settlement reached in Europe at the end of the Cold War. He's used his military to change borders in Georgia, to change borders in Ukraine. And his statements suggest he's willing to change borders elsewhere in the post-Soviet space, including in the Baltics. And, of course, the three Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, happen to be NATO allies. So the danger he poses to us is substantial. He is the greatest national security threat at the moment.
Ambassador Hertz, we're going to be talking shortly with Bill Gertz, who's, I think, going to reinforce this point by describing some of the very ominous developments that the Russians are engaged in with respect to building up their nuclear forces, including in ways that now represent a serial violation of the intermediate-range nuclear force agreements. To what extent, as you look at this sort of from a strategic vantage point, not just as the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, but, you know, looking at this region more broadly, to what extent do you think that you're actually going to see Putin using violence in an even greater form and perhaps the threat of even nuclear violence to effect these kinds of further changes that he's contemplating?
I believe that Putin can be stopped by strong Western policy. Unfortunately, we have not really seen that. The West is still not fully cognizant of the danger Putin represents. You know, when our new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff made that statement that Russia is the greatest threat we face today, it was discounted by the White House the next day. The president does not understand the danger that Mr. Putin represents. I give President Obama high marks on the sanctions policy towards Russia, but he's been weak within the NATO context, weak in providing Ukraine the weapons it needs to defend itself. Of course, you can't have a strong Western policy without White House leadership. So if the White House does not understand the problem, the West will not respond appropriately. Although the president's policy is getting better, it's still not good enough.
You've mentioned that the price of oil is down, of course. There is nonetheless, as you know so well, a very considerable energy weapon in the Kremlin's toolkit. It has been using it against Ukraine over the years. It has, to varying degrees, used it either directly or indirectly against the Europeans. talk a bit about how that's likely to play into the kind of aggressive rewriting of the map of Europe that Putin evidently has in mind, Ambassador John Herbst.
Mr. Putin's position, geostrategic position, is getting weaker by the week. His gas weapon, which he has deployed against Ukraine a couple of times, he deployed against Belarus. He effectively deployed it, I mean, you might say essentially deployed it against Europe indirectly. He can't afford to deploy now. He can't afford to deploy it for two reasons. One, he needs every dollar he can get or every euro he can get from the West for his cratering economy, which will drop, by official estimates, 4% GDP this year, but by more realistic estimates, double that, 7 or 8%. So he can't afford to employ it. But also, his own weaponization of gas in the past has encouraged Europe to seek alternate energy supplies. So Lithuania now has this liquefied natural gas terminal, so it can import natural gas from elsewhere around the world. We've seen the shale revolution in the United States bring oil on stream, which has contributed to the drop in energy prices. Ukraine was able to get through last winter without having to pay exorbitant prices to Russia for gas because they had begun to diversify and because Europe helped them diversify supplies. I think the gas weapon for Mr. Putin is kaput, and he's responsible for it. His own greed and his own aggression has led to that.
To what extent, and this, unfortunately, is our closing question to you, Ambassador John Herbst, but to what extent do you think his weakening strategic position and his inability to wield the energy weapon as he has in the past, again, intensifies the probability that this guy will lash out in ways that may be very dangerous for our interests and allies in NATO and beyond?
I think that's a legitimate question. Mr. Putin has proved to be a risk taker in a way that few people have anticipated. But having said that, he's not crazy. Certainly, people around him understand Russia's current weakness. And he was stunned, for example, by the fact that Europe has kept the sanctions on. He was really hoping he'd be able to get an ease in sanctions, if not a lift. But the Europeans, under Chancellor Merkel's leadership, have held strong. If he were, for example, to launch a major offensive in Ukraine, I think that would prompt the Europeans to increase sanctions. I don't think anything else would. And I think that would prompt even President Obama to wind up sending weapons to Ukraine. And Mr. Putin can't afford that.
Mr. Messer, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for your time today, as always, and for the service you've rendered to our country in numerous capacities in our foreign service, and now with the Atlantic Council. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. Bill Gertz joins us next. We'll talk about that nuclear threat from Russia and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. The Obama administration's efforts to defend the controversial nuclear deal with Iran has become ugly, very ugly. Last week, during a speech at American University, the president portrayed opponents of the deal as partisan Republicans in common cause with Death to America chanting Iranian hardliners. The Tablet, a daily online Jewish magazine, ran an editorial on August 7th claiming that the president is using code anti-Semitic language to criticize Jewish Americans for opposing the Iran deal and to blame them if the deal is rejected by Congress. Some liberal pro-Obama groups have gone further and have questioned the loyalty to this country of Jewish members of Congress who oppose the deal, such as New York Senator Chuck Schumer. The president and his supporters are stooping to smearing opponents of the deal because the agreement is so awful and they cannot defend it on its merits. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're going inside the ring with Bill Gertz, the author of that prize-winning column at the Washington Times, also the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon, one of the country's truly foremost and most acclaimed national security reporters, and a good friend of this program. We're always glad to have him with us. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, good to be on the show.
We were talking earlier in the program with Congresswoman Vicki Hartzler about her concerns about what the president's up to with respect to Guantanamo Bay. Bill, you've reported on evidence that he is, in fact, trying to defy the will of Congress, and I think that of the vast majority of Americans, by bringing some of those detainees, at least, here. Give us the latest on that.
Yes, this was the lead item in my Washington Times Inside the Ring column this week about how the Pentagon and the Obama administration are heading for a showdown with Congress over attempts to close down the Gitmo prison facility. The Pentagon announced last week through Defense Secretary Ash Carter that they're looking at two facilities, at least one in Leavenworth, Kansas, the other in Charleston, South Carolina, where they're going to house some of the terrorists that are currently there. There's about 116 prisoners there now, and they're divided into two groups, one of whom can be transferred to foreign countries and others who are deemed incorrigible terrorists and can't be released without having them go out and kill more Americans. So this has been a cause of friction between the Pentagon and the White House. The White House has been pushing the Pentagon to release these. I was told that it was one of the reasons that Chuck Hagel, the previous defense secretary, was forced out, was that he didn't want to go in a irresponsible fashion and release these terrorists. And it appears that Ash Carter, the current defense secretary, is also facing that similar pressure because he made it very clear that he has a responsibility not to release it. One defense official told me that he doesn't want his name on one of those release slips for one of those terrorists, and then they're going to go out and kill more Americans. So that's kind of the state of play.
Well, it certainly sounds as though there will be more of that coming if these guys are let loose. And frankly, I'm as concerned about the ones that they will let go off to some other country, because those are almost certainly going to wind up back in the fight.
Well, that's the other side, is the congressional side. And Congress, in the House bill, has very strong language currently, which basically says that the Pentagon cannot use any of its money to transfer terrorists, whether it's in the U.S. or abroad or in a combat zone. So whether this language survives the House-Senate conference, which should be concluded next week, remains to be seen. But because the administration lied in the Bergdahl Taliban 5 release, the thinking is that the House language will stay, and that will lead to a showdown with the president.
Yeah. Well, and my understanding is there's laws on the books to that effect already. So this is really a question of violating the law to bring these people here in the first place, I think. And we'll be following this closely, Bill. Let me ask you about China. You've been doing extraordinarily important reporting on, among other things, their hypersonic technologies, which are now apparently about to go operational. Give us a flavor of what's happening on that front and the implications, as well as some of the other insights into the Chinese military buildup from a recent parade there in Beijing.
The Chinese conducted the fifth test of a new hypersonic strike vehicle. This is a ultra-high speed, talking over nearly 8,000 miles an hour, and it's a maneuvering nuclear delivery vehicle, which can also be used with conventional precision strike to go after our aircraft carriers. The fifth task shows that this within the last 2 years, is a high-priority program and is probably close to being fielded. The U.S., on the other hand, is developing hypersonics but is out of money and has not really devoted the effort to it. So there's really kind of a hypersonic arms race going on, and the U.S. is kind of losing out to the Chinese.
Well, importantly, we're not doing too well in having defenses against these things either, as best I can tell. According to Admiral Gortney, the commander of Northern Command, we're doing rather poorly in the missile defense area, and I think it's in part unless a reference to this problem.
Yes, he is very concerned. Admiral Gortney made some comments about missile defense. His concern is the growing cruise missile threat to the U.S., and I reported on that this week as well. The Russians have a new long-range cruise missile, which probably violates the INF Treaty. That's the 87 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. And this is a real big concern because it's even though it's a naval missile, it appears that they've got a ground-launch cruise missile version of it, which could target all of Europe. So this is part of the new emerging cruise missile threat.
And this is a supersonic cruise missile, as I understand it, Bill Gertz.
Yes, it has a range of about 900 miles.
It turns out, and we sort of cut you off with respect to what the Chinese are also now beginning to tout, I gather they've also got an intermediate range missile. One of the problems with the old INF treaty, of course, was that it bound the United States and the Soviet Union not to have those kinds of weapons. And as you say, the Russians have violated that. But there was no impediment to other nations like the Chinese acquiring such capabilities, and I gather they're in the process of doing so.
They're having a military parade September 3rd. It's kind of a bogus propaganda show giving the communists some role in World War II, even though communist China didn't exist until after World War II, and that the nationalists were in power at the time. Yet they're using this anniversary to show off a new DF-26 intermediate-range missile. This is a very effective weapon against U.S. military facilities in the Pacific. It adds to their growing arsenal of ballistic missiles, and it's raising real concerns within the Pentagon. They're going to show it off in this parade, along with at least six other missile systems.
We'll be watching it closely. Speaking of U.S. interests and defenses in the Pacific, Bill Gertz, one of the places that has been tamped down at the moment, but talk a little bit about what you've reported on North Korea's underground missile complex and more broadly what the North Koreans are up to.
Yeah, the U.S. intelligence community recently discovered that North Korea has an extensive underground missile complex at their Sohae Space Launch facility, and includes both places to assemble missiles as well as to fuel them. And this is designed to avoid U.S. reconnaissance and neighboring countries' efforts to prepare for any missile launches. So it's raising some concerns about what the North Koreans are up to. They're expected this coming September or October to conduct a long-range missile test, which again could destabilize the region, which is already, we had recent heightened tensions between the North and South, and they seem to have subsided somewhat after an agreement to try and hold some regular North-South talks.
Yeah. Bill, you've mentioned that this is a program that seems to have been underway for about a decade. It's a reminder of how little we actually know about what's going on in these secretive societies, including that of the North Koreans' allies, Iran, a point that ought to be borne in mind as people think about this Iran nuclear deal. Bill, let me close by asking you about a report that you had that there seems to have been, in connection with the recent passage by two women into the ranks of the United States Army's Rangers, some dumbing down of the standards. This has been worried about for some time. This has been, I gather, denied by the Obama administration, but talk a little bit about your findings.
Yeah, according to Army sources, there were some playing with the rules and conditions for that allowed these women to pass the course, one of which was the evaluation process was not the same for the two women as it was for the men, and a lot of people in the Army are kind of crying foul over that this is, again, part of the social engineering, politically correct Obama administration policy. Here our military is in a crisis over defense budgets, and it seems that the only thing the Pentagon is concerned about is integrating women into combat slots. It's kind of a misguided policy, in my view.
Well, especially if it has the effect of compounding the problems for the United States military's combat capability, as I fear it will, especially if they're playing games with the standards by which these women are admitted. Bill, thanks for the terrific job you do covering all of these fronts and for joining us each week to discuss your reporting. Keep it up, my friend. We'll talk with you again next week. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.